Ought to can't go in there. Another man joined him, but my momentum carried all of us forward through the pools of water, reflecting fire at our feet. It was like the world was in flames, but I'd seen fire up on the mountain and was unafraid. Walt, if he's in there, he's dead. I shrugged them off and continued toward the closed front door. Not this guy. Gilbert made a last grab, dragging my jacket down my arm. Walt, there are chemicals from the bus barn that this building lodges up against. That whole back area is going to go up any minute. His last grasp had turned me just a little. You can't go in there. I stared at him for an instant and then yanked my arm completely free, sending him falling backward toward a group of men holding one of the hoses. My boots slipped on the puddled asphalt, but I got my footing back and, feeling the intensity of the heat on my face, lurched toward the door and pulled my gloves out of my coat pockets. Holding one of my gloved hands up to protect my face as I planted a staggering shoulder into the door, I exploded it inward, the glass with the Absaroka Sheriff's Department seal shattering as my hand struck the middle of the pane, the shards cascading out like a broken spider's web. The flames rushed toward me as I tripped, like something alive in pursuit of the fresh, cool oxygen of the night. It was lucky that I'd fallen, because there was a ceiling of black smoke about waist high, with flames licking at the corrugated steel of the perimeter, all of them making for the door I just came through. The desk and chairs to my left were on fire, along with the stacks of newspapers that had concerned me earlier. To my right, the decrepit sofa burned, the smoldering edges of the carpet remnant were curling upward into flames, and the paint was peeling off the walls in burning strips that slid toward the floor. Suddenly, something with the force of a buffalo pushed me forward, smashing my face against the glass and flattening me against the door on the floor. Whatever it was, it stayed there, and it took every measure of strength I had to press up onto my hands and knees. It was only when my hat skidded forward toward the inner doorway and I felt the rivulets of water falling down the sides of my face that I realized the pressure was from the hoses Gilbert and the volunteer firemen were directing on me to keep me from becoming barbecue. It shot around me, making a prismatic outline of my bulk in a mist that evaporated instantaneously. I staggered up only to be knocked down again by the hundreds of gallons that were propelling me forward. My hand hit the soaked surface of the sodden carpet, and I crouched, deciding that, between the fire and the high-pressure water, I damn well better stay low. I watched as my hat hit the door where I had seen Doubletuff's cot, and I felt the heat just above the top of my head, even as the water attempted to beat back the carnivorous flames. And heaving my shoulders forward, I drove with my knees, which made me feel like I was back at USC pushing blocking sleds. I tried to breathe through the fingers of my glove, but the water poured off me like a forking river, and I felt like I might drown before I got there. Widening my eyes and trying to keep my bearings along with my balance, I stared ahead. The door was closed, and the brim of my hat, lodged under its edge, was slapping up and down like some seabird attempting to take flight. I reached out and pulled it back toward me, figuring a little dripping beaver fur protection was better than no protection at all. There was a whooshing sound above me to my right, and the quad sheet map came floating through the smoke to land on top of me. I could see the ink on the thing blackened from the heat, tracing a straight line toward the door. Using both hands, I pushed myself up from the carpet and the inch-deep puddle and skimmed forward into the wall beside the back door. The plywood the map had been mounted on was on my back, deflecting the two blasting jets of water up into the rounded top of the corrugated ceiling, driving the smoke long enough for me to partially stand. Some idiot voice in the back of my head told me to feel the door before opening it, but I barked back at it, fully tasting the smoke, ash, and moisture in my spoken words. I know there's a fire behind the damn thing. There's fire everywhere. I reached down with my saturated gloved hand and watched the water drain from my grip, the knob not turning. Who knew why? Possibly because the boards were warped from the heat. Possibly because Doubletuff was afraid of monsters. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered except getting through the door and getting him out of there. I knew what was going to happen when I shouldered the thing open, so I bumped the cheap two-panel door just to get prepared, figuring I'd blow through and fall onto the concrete floor as the flames came out. I put everything I had into the crouching bulrush and felt my feet come right off the ground as the pressure from inside the superheated room escaped, carrying the two neatly halved portions of the door and my hunched body backward into the main office. The sound stuffed my ears and stayed there as I lay on the soaked rug for a moment, trying to clear my head. My hat was bumping against my face, and I caught it with one hand before it could attempt a repeat performance and run away with the force of the water. I jammed it on again, dumping a good gallon onto my face in the process, and then half-crawled, half-slithered toward the door, the pressurized jet stream still hitting me as I hand and kneaded across the floor. The doorway was glowing, and I was sure the flames were ingesting the old wood and then vomiting the coats of leaded paint that made up the lean-to, not to mention the unknown horrors in the 55-gallon drums in the bus barn at the other side of the exterior wall. No one could be alive in there. No one. Not even Double Tough. I pitched forward again, but the smoke was like a shroud and hung even lower than before, instantly gritting my eyes, nose, and mouth. I shifted the wet glove in front of my face again and breathed as shallowly as I could, coughed, and tried to get the stuff out of some passage or another, but only succeeded in clearing my ears, the only sensory organ I didn't particularly need. I remembered that the cot was against the center of the back wall, and I started crawling in that direction. The blasts of water were still prodding me forward, now hitting me in the ass, and all I could think of was how I was going to knock the damn hoses out of the volunteer fireman's hands when and if I got out of there. I could feel the leg of the low-slung cot and was amazed the aluminum hadn't melted in the heat. I felt for the mattress and found the sopping blankets, my hand bumping against something that felt like a shoulder. I grabbed hold of it but couldn't get a grip, so I gathered all the covers, yanked them toward me, and felt the fabric tear. Going for broke, I shot both arms over the top and clamped them down like hooks. The cot collapsed, and a 200-pound man slapped against my chest, and I fell backward. Damn it to hell! I closed my mouth and just pulled his lifeless body along with me back toward the door. We were only a few leg drags in that direction when I heard a cracking noise and saw part of the shed roof disengage and fall, taking a third of the joists with it, the sudden rush of air momentarily pulling the flames and smoke toward the other side, at which point I could see that the rafters on my side were in no better shape. Grabbing the wet bundle that was Double Tough, I prepared for a mad dash through the doorway into the hose streams and the parking lot. This hope was hammered as I watched the top beam disconnect from the back of the Quonset hut and slam down diagonally in front of me in a cascade of sparks, flame, burning wood, and tar paper. I scrambled backward until my shoulders lodged against the skillet-hot, ridged surface of one corner. I was trapped, like a rat, and yelling like a madman. Double Tough was lying across my legs. The side of his head was badly burned, and I wasn't even sure that the eye was still there. He wasn't breathing, and all I could do was pull his body next to me and try to think fast. I wasn't sure what was still on the other side, but it had to be better than this. I hoisted the two of us, shrugging Double Tough's body against my chest again in a modified fireman's carry, and prepared for the hunched dash to freedom. All I could think was that I couldn't stop. No matter what happened, keep going. I had pulled some of the soaked blankets over me for a little protection, but I couldn't see because they covered my head. Suddenly it felt like the wall behind me was giving way. I half expected the remainder of the ceiling to come crashing down and tottered forward, still in hopes of finding a way out. About then, two great weights slammed onto my shoulders, and the only thing I could think was that the roof had finally let go and the 16-inch centered rafters had landed on either side of my neck. I struggled to pull free, but I could feel myself losing my balance, and I fell backward, crashing into the exterior wall. The grip on my shoulders didn't let up. Something was dragging me. I held onto Double Tough's body as I shot backward, but the smoke was invading the blankets at this height. My brain started to fog, and the grip on my shoulders felt like talons digging into my flesh. This must have been what it was like to die. A giant messenger of the dead, swooping down and carrying me along that hanging road to the camp beyond. The talons had to be from some giant owl, the only bird that eagles steered clear of. His claws sunk deeper, and I felt the circulation cut off from my arms. I hit the hard ground and just lay there with the weight of the wet bedding and Double Tough's body on top of me, trying to summon enough energy for another go, not dead yet. Suddenly, his body disappeared. I lifted my arms and tried to get hold of him, but there was nothing there. I flopped to my side and tried to pull the blankets off of me, but it was as if I were glued to them. Slowly, I backpedaled out from under and finally slid my head clear. I rolled over on my back and breathed, staring at the star-filled night and feeling the cold just starting to sink its teeth in. I felt around, but still couldn't find his body anywhere nearby. It would appear that the giant owl, having given up on taking both of us, had dropped me and continued onto the camp of the dead with him alone. The hanging road was there, the thick strip of the Milky Way draped like a hammock from horizon to horizon in icy clarity. I allowed my head to drop back onto the parking lot pavement and then rolled it the other way, finally seeing what had plucked my deputy and me from the burning building. The giant owl was beating on Double Tough's chest. I watched as my deputy's head bounced against the asphalt. I reached out but couldn't get to him. I yelled and shouted for the thing to go away, slapped my hand on the ground, in an attempt to get his attention, but it ignored me and went back to tearing at Doubletop's chest in some sort of ceremonial rite. I raised my voice but could only croak out a warning that if I got my hands around the big owl's neck, it was going to rue the day he had decided to make birdseed out of us. Finally, the owl swiveled its head, shuddered, and took notice of me. I tried to sit up, but it pinned me to the ground. I coughed and choked up some of the soot from my throat and spat it to the side, then turned to grab hold of him in return. The big bird fell to the side, seemingly as exhausted as I was. I still held onto the legs of the thing, but then slowly realized that they were arms. It shook me loose and reached up to pull away its own wet protective blanket that hung over its head, revealing Henry's smudged and dirty face. He sat there looking at me as I sank back to the pavement, but only for a moment, then turned and looked toward the fire, the wetness in his eyes reflecting the flames as they consumed the rest of the Absaroka County Sheriff's substation. I said something, but he wouldn't look at me. Feeling the weight on my head as it slipped sideways, I could see another set of eyes looking at me from a short distance away. Doubletop. I dragged myself across the asphalt through a couple of puddles and began to shake from the cold. My hand reached his face, the scorched glove touching his chin. But he didn't blink. Chapter 12. I sat on the tailgate of my truck, sipped at a styrofoam cup of coffee, and pulled the dry blanket a little closer around me, attempting to quell the constant shivering. I watched as the Powder River Fire District volunteers recoiled their hoses and gathered their gear to beat a tired retreat back to the firehouse and their beds. The EMTs had loaded Doubletop into their van and had left. Henry's voice sounded distant. One of the neighbors from across the street says he saw the light from inside but just thought it was the reflection from a wood-burning stove. The next time he looked, he said the entire building was going up. I lowered the cup and looked at the pool of illumination from the dusk to dawn light on the other side of the parking lot, the halogen spilling onto the faded red Suburban, pink and unearthly. The truck sat there like some bashful ingenue at center stage, backed against a copse of fledgling aspens, leaning in like a parted curtain. I remembered how much better the thing had run after Doubletop had taken it under his mechanical wing. How numerous times when I had made the drive down to deliver paychecks, I would find his hillbilly ass under the hood of the 30-year-old unit, reveling in the big block carbureted dual-exhausted monstrosity. There were some other individuals at the periphery behind the sawhorses. I interviewed them, but none of them appeared to have seen anything. I remember Doubletop telling me he was from someplace back east, some hollow in the middle of the Appalachian Mountains, about how he'd gotten a degree in geology or mineralogy or something. I thought about how I'd wished I'd listened more closely to his story. Walter. I stared at the truck and thought about what a dinosaur it was and how it was a lot like him. Unsophisticated, honest, and durable. There is nothing more you could have done. I stood, dumping the rest of the coffee from the cup and tossing the container into a bucket that served as a trash receptacle, and, pulling the blanket up higher, squished my way toward the large SUV with the Cheyenne Nation in tow. I heard you yelling, punched through the wall, grabbed you by your shoulders, and pulled you out. He probably did not know what happened, Walt. The sun would be up in a few hours, the dawn of a new day. From the flats of the Powder River Country, a gaseous ball of hydrogen, billions of degrees in heat, would brighten the mountains behind me. I would meet that day with a serious degree of heat myself, a smoldering little ember that would become the size of a man, I'd say most certainly more than one, which I would tinder until I could find just the right fuel. Walter. I fumed like the fuse on a bundle of dynamite and looked at my best friend in the world, the man who had just saved my life again. The bear stared into my face and didn't like what he found there. But knowing me as he did, he didn't say anything, just kept pace. I took the last few steps and stopped at the corner of the official vehicle of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department, my department, and stared through the back window of the Suburban. Double Tuft's clothes were piled in the back, and it looked as if nothing had been disturbed. I hitched the old army blanket higher to cover my neck, turned the tail end of the thing flaring with my effort, and walked toward the crumpled husk of the substation with the bear trailing after me. He moved a little to the right in an attempt to see the side of my face with those dark eyes of his, seemingly darker than before, his eyes always growing deeper and more liquid as these crucial emotional moments became a part of his soul. At what used to be the front door, I looked straight at him to assure him that I wasn't just wandering, sidestepped in, and went over to the scorched, empty key rack. I stepped on something and stooped to pick up a set of keys that were under a couple of inches of dirty water. They were on a funny ring I'd never noticed before, from some second or maybe third-tier amusement park with an image of a giant character who looked a little like Bozo leaning on a structure that read Camden Park at the sign of the Happy Clown. There was something else, too, that I noticed as I bent over. The vague scent of kerosene. I turned around and started back toward the Suburban. I flipped to the second key and attempted to get it somewhere in the vicinity of the keyhole that unlocked the tailgate. My hands continued to shake, and the damn thing fell on the ground. I started to lean down, but the Cheyenne Nation was quicker, as usual, even catching them before they struck the pavement. He stood and slipped in front of me, and I listened to the unctuous whir of the window going down. He reached inside, pulled the latch, flipping down the tailgate, and glanced back at me, standing there quaking. "You need to get out of those clothes." I pointed a quivering hand at the dirty laundry and willed my finger to stop shaking. If it didn't, I silently swore I was going to bite it off. It must have heard me and grew steady. Henry sighed and pushed the clothing that smelled like my deputy aside till there was nothing but the ribbed surface of the Chevrolet's floor. He turned to look at me and then walked around the vehicle, systematically unlocking and opening each door, looking inside and then closing it. He finished his investigation, had circled the vehicle, and, leaning against the quarter panel, stopped beside me. "Nothing." I nodded, still staring at the back of the beat-up truck. "Inside the substation. Did you smell kerosene?" "Yes." When I extended my hand, he'd already pulled his cell phone from his shirt pocket and handed it to me with Vern Selby's number punched in and ringing. I held the device to my ear and waited through five rings before Vern's wife, Rebecca, answered their phone. She whispered, "Hello?"
"Rebecca, it's Walt. I need to speak with Vern."
There was a rustling of sheets and her voice rose.
"Walter, do you know what time it is?"
"As a matter of fact, I don't. And I don't mean to be rude, but give me Vern."
I heard her talk to the judge, and after a moment I heard his voice.
"Hello? I need a warrant."
He cleared his voice.
"Now?"
"Now.
I can get the paperwork going in the morning,
right now. I'm going into East Spring Ranch down near Short Drop, with or without a warrant. You can back me up with some paperwork, or I can just go in there on my own. I'm in Powder Junction right now, and either way, I'm headed south in a few minutes."
I could almost see him nodding into the receiver.
"I'll fax it to the sheriff's substation." I took a breath, staring at the powdery paint of Double Tuft's unit, but refusing to look at the burned-out corpse of a structure across the parking lot. "Send it to the town hall instead."
"We are waiting?"
"We are not." We were standing at the counter of the Powder Junction town hall with Brian Kinnison, in anticipation of the warrant, when the bear sabotaged me by handing me his cell phone again. I looked at him, but he gestured for me to talk and walked away.
"What the fuck are you doing?"
I sighed. "I'm going in there, and none too friendly."
"Then what?"
"I'm going to find out what's going on, and I'm going to get who did this." I could hear her struggling to get her boots on.
"You need help."
"I've got help.
I'll be there in 20 minutes.
"I'll be gone in 5. I walked over to Henry and handed the phone to him.
"Here."
Vic was still yelling on the other end. I returned to the counter just as Brian was pulling the papers out of the fax machine. He put them on the flat surface and looked at me.
"You're sure these people did this?"
"Yep, I am."
"You want me to alert the militia?"
I half smiled in spite of myself. I didn't know you had one.
He glanced at the clock on the wall and smiled back. Seems like a good time to start one off.
I stuffed the warrant in the inside pocket of my jacket, which wafted the smell of a dead campfire, sat my water-mauled hat on my head a little straighter, and started out the door. Henry was waiting for me as I hit Powder Junction's one-block boardwalk, and I could see he was thinking. I stepped up, even with him, and asked,
"Why the substation? Why not just take the bit? They had to know this was going to start a war."
"Yes."
"But why him? I was the one pushing. I'm the one most likely to go after them."
I patted the papers in my pocket. "This guarantees it."
"Yes."
"They thought they could steamroll us out here in the middle of nowhere and get away with it?" I stuck an index finger toward him. "Don't say yes."
He grunted. "I am hoping that is not the case."
I gestured to the tiny street. "Because he was closer?" The bear shrugged.
"We are only 40 minutes away."
20, according to Vic.
He nodded. "We should be going. I think I can keep you from shooting people, but I am not sure I can dissuade her."
I climbed in on the driver's side and pulled the door closed behind me as the bear slung himself in. I watched as he reached over, pulled the Remington Wingmaster from the brace that held it against the dash and transmission hump, and jacked the breech of the 12-gauge like a sidekick in some bullshit TV show where they did such things a dozen times. The unspent shell went flying into the back, unlike on TV, and I looked at him. "We might need that round." He smiled, and a line settled alongside the upturned corner of his mouth as he popped the lid on the center console. He knew all my caches and cliches, and pulled out an extra box of shells.
"What other weapons do we have?"
I started the bullet and pulled the gear selector down into drive.
"Steadfast resolution."
I turned and looked at him, not as if he would take the option, but it had to be said. "If you want out, now would be the time." He actually laughed as he reloaded the round.
"I try never to miss an episode of Steadfast Resolution. It is my favorite program."
The Cheyenne Nation was the first to notice that the lights were on at the short drop murk. I slowed my truck from its sonic speed and pulled to the side of the road, just past the turnoff into the pint-sized town. I leaned forward. It seemed as though almost every light in the place was on, especially in the bar, and a few vehicles were parked out front, including a decked-out Ford King Ranch pickup. The bear shook his head.
"You do not think—"
"Yes, I do." I threw the bullet into reverse, scorching the scoria surface of Route 192 with two black strips of Michelin rubber about 90 feet long. I locked it up and spun the wheel, bouncing the 3/4 ton over the edge of the pavement and down the slight grade leading into town past the signature hemp noose that swung from the cottonwood. I kept my brights on as I slid up to the boardwalk hitching post alongside the other vehicles, my headlights directed into the front windows, a copious cloud of dry, ochre-colored dust drifting past us and blowing against the structure like an angry orange smell.
"I take it we are not counting on the element of surprise?"
I threw my door open.
"Nope."
His hand caught mine as I started to exit.
"Does not make sense. Remember that."
I looked at him, said nothing, and then nodded. We mounted the steps, and I didn't bother with the knob, instead choosing to enter the room boot first. The door bounced off the wall and started back, but I caught it with one hand and stood there holding it. I noticed my hands had stopped shaking for good. The only person in the room that I did not want to shoot was standing behind the bar with her hands on her hips, keeping enough collateral damage distance between her and what appeared to be her unwanted patrons. Smart woman, that Eleanor Tisdale. There were 3 men at the bar and 2 more playing pool at the table to my left. I noticed the Cheyenne Nation drifting in the door behind me like casual death, the shotgun trailing behind his leg, completely unnoticeable.
"Well, howdy, Sheriff. You look like you could use a drink."
I looked at the 3, especially at the one with the mouth whom I recognized as Ronald, Roy Lanier's oldest son, the one from over in South Dakota. Behind him were Lockhart and the younger Strongarm, whose acquaintance I'd made from a distance in Butte County. Gloss and Bidarte were at the pool table, and the bear had already taken a few steps in that direction. Having cased and set the room, I started toward Ronald and Lockhart, and watched as the muscle slid in front of them. I guess they thought they had numbers on their side, but maybe they had never seen an episode of Steadfast Resolution, let alone the season finale. Lockhart was the unstated leader, I was sure of that, but he lingered and made no move to engage me. I hit the younger one a good solid roundhouse to the side of his head, which sent him into the bar where he made the mistake of trying to catch himself. I took that opportunity to uppercut him and send him back, dragging along a few glasses and more than a few beer bottles with him as he fell. The favorite son and Lockhart didn't move and stayed there, not lifting a hand from the edge. Ronald Lanier's eyes widened as I pulled up over him, my nose about an inch or two higher than the top of his head. His face turned upward as I made a show of breathing in his scent. He appeared to be paralyzed, but finally eased out the words in a smoother voice than I would have thought him capable of in such a situation.
"Do you mind if I ask what you're doing, Sheriff?"
I breathed in deeply. They say that guilt has a specific odor, one you can smell from a mile away. He waited a moment and then asked,
"And what is it that one of us might be guilty of?"
Still sniffing like a bloodhound, I leaned a little to the side. "The willful destruction of county property."
"You don't say."
I brought my face around to his. "I do." Leaving him, I stepped over the fallen man and gave Lockhart the once-over. "You see, the sheriff's substation..." I glanced back at Lanier and then settled my eyes on Lockhart again. "The county property in question was burned with a chemical accelerant, probably kerosene." I bent down to the glass-jawed guy, slid a Wilson Combat Tactical 40 from his inside-the-pants holster and propelled it across the gray hardwood floor where it lodged under Henry's uplifted boot with a solid thunk. Nobody moved. I sniffed the younger man's head and then lifted an arm, attaching one end of my handcuffs to his wrist. "Guilt is a lot like kerosene. The scent stays longer than you might suspect." I dragged the cuffed individual along by the arm like an afterthought, turned toward Gloss and Vidarte, and took a few steps into the center of the room. Gloss put the butt of his pool cue on the floor, his hand tightening around the shaft of it, and glanced at Henry and then at me.
"You stay the hell away!"
The bear and I looked at each other, and he was the first to speak.
"That sounded remarkably like an admission of guilt."
"Yep, it did." I cocked my head. "You wouldn't be armed again, would you, Mr. Gloss?" I gestured with the unconscious man's arm. "I mean, not like your friend here, who I'm betting is going to be spending a few weeks in my jail in violation of the carry laws of the state of Wyoming." I stepped to one side of the table, and they counted by moving to the other.
"Do you have another weapon on you by any chance? I took the last one you had, which means if you didn't acquire a different one, you would have to find some other way of doing your dirty work, something like an accelerant, say, kerosene?"
He glanced at Henry and then at me, and the holstered 45 on my hip. His eyes came back up to mine, and I could see the panic-driven thought that was there. I reached down and drew back my jacket and unsnapped the safety strap for my Colt. "It doesn't take much to carry one of these things, 40 ounces of milled steel in 8 rounds. I pointed toward his shirt tail hanging past his waist. "Whatever you've maybe got there probably carries more, but caliber, rate of fire, that doesn't really matter. Doesn't mean anything, really. All that matters is being willing. Willing to pull it. Willing to fire it. Willing to kill." I took another step, still dragging the now half-conscious man along with me. "It's one thing to set a place on fire with a man sleeping inside. But it's another when a man is standing right in front of you, ready and willing." Vidarte sidestepped slightly to the left, but carefully raised his hands, keeping them where Henry and I could see them.
"I don't know what this is all about, Sheriff, but we've been here playing pool all night."
He gestured toward Eleanor and kept moving sideways.
"The lady, she can tell you
that's far enough. I'm not that bad a shot." He smiled but stopped. I glanced at the proprietor, and she shrugged with a sad humping of her shoulders.
"They came in here around 6, all of them."
She looked away.
"I wish I could tell you something different, but I can't."
I looked over to Henry and remembered what he said before we'd entered. "It does not make sense. Remember that." When I turned back, I could see Gloss had dropped his hand and was starting to raise it toward the underside of his shirt tail. There were about 6 feet between me and him, which was the range in which most sidearm fatalities took place. You shouldn't miss from that distance, but then again neither should I. Gloss started to shift his weight.
Look, I don't know what you're talking about.
He glanced to my right, where Lockhart was watching him. I heard a noise behind me. The Cheyenne Nation must have stooped to pick up the pistol, but I was pretty sure it was the shotgun that he was aiming in Gloss's direction. I cleared my throat.
Now, in these types of situations, if you're properly trained, the next step would be to distract the assailant just long enough for the primary target to pull his weapon. But I've nullified that possibility by having backup. Right, Henry?
You bet your lily white ass.
I gestured toward Gloss's waist. I'll tell you what. If you want to get it out of your pants and ready to go, that's fine by me. His lips moved, but it took a few seconds for him to come up with something to add.
Look, is this some kind of joke?
My turn not to say anything. He shook his head, stared at the long green of the felt, and looked at the ceiling.
I want a lawyer.
Place your weapon on the table, thumb and forefinger only. He made a show of doing exactly that, and carefully placed another high-priced carbon steel .45 with some kind of fancy finish on the flat surface. I reached across and picked it up.
You want to smell me now?
It was the wrong thing to say at the exact wrong time, and I made that clear by bringing the butt of the semi-automatic up and popping it into his nose.